Flux capacitor is flux. Oh, wow, that was incredibly fast. Usually it takes a little bit longer than that. I feel like I should apologize, but now we are on the air. Hey, folks, thanks for tuning into the Math Podcast. I'm your host, Michael Lafferty, and this is our semi-regular weekly pop culture chat. And with us today, we've got recurring guest and RPG luminary, Sean Patrick Fannin. How you doing, Sean?
Hey, glad to be here. How's it going?
I hear you're fresh off an AMA over on Reddit. How'd that go?
Surprisingly well. I am neither on fire nor in the hospital, so kind of surprised. I really expected that to be way more painful than it was, and it was actually really cool.
Yeah, the RPG right over there is okay. I mean, things get sparky sometimes, but often it's pretty civil. So I'm glad you had a good experience. That's cool. And joining us for the first time ever is Ryan Leibarger. And Ryan, should we introduce you as the head designer at Utility Games, or what is your title over there?
There's only three of us. Titles are kind of nebulous at this point. I would say I did rules design, but we all pitched in our hats for that. You may notice I'm showing up as Cinda. That's my wife. She's helping as well. And then our friend Brian Rowe is the main graphic designer and dice designer, I guess I should say.
Okay, cool. Well, we can segue awkwardly over to Kickstarter promotion towards the second half of the show, if that's
Sure.
cool.
Oh, yeah.
And a frequent co-host hanging out there towards the end of my virtual studio is Walt Rebilliard. How you doing, Walt?
For freedom. Sorry.
For freedom. Thank you, Walt. Appreciate the cheap plug.
Yes, sir.
That's Sean is running a Kickstarter that has that catchphrase associated with it that we'll be touching on later in the show. But first, we talk pop culture, and I'll start, I guess, just to get the ball rolling. There is a new incarnation of the Tick on Amazon right now, and they just premiered the second half of season one. Why don't they just call these things like season two? If you take a 3 month break between episodes, I just call it a new season. But anyway, it was not as funny as I expected, and a lot more dramatic and impactful than I think the Tick has any right to be. I mean, it was really surprising to me how well they pulled it off. So I'd highly recommend it. It was a good time, and I'm curious to see where they go from here. So,
So it wasn't a whole, bring him to the pants and I'm doing laundry.
They kind of there's the occasional one-liner. Every 4 or 5 minutes, someone has a throwaway joke like that. And there's a couple of visual gags, like the main villain's called the Terror, and his giant ship of doom, a ship like a giant T. And at the end, someone is escaping when it's blowing up, and they run into an escape pod and punch out, and it flows away, and it's a lowercase t, zooming away into the distance. So, there's a couple of cheap jokes like that, but they actually have a fairly serious plot line about, Arthur's childhood trauma and, how this fight against the Terror is resolving it. It sounds cheesy as hell when I say it out loud, but they managed to actually, imbue the Tick with some gravitas, and it's
Huh.
earned. So I was surprised. I really couldn't believe that they managed to do that with the Tick. And
So
Gonna have to.
Chairface Chippendale doesn't show up?
Chippendale does not show up, no. That's too
There's
bad.
no chair face Chippendale. I don't know if I can watch this. I don't know. And
Well,
what about the guy, baker or whatever with Butterby Pat and all that? I mean, come on, man.
you could just consider an alternate universe version of the Tick.
Oh, we don't do that. No. Says the guy who loves the Marvel Cinematic Universe. So,
Yeah.
yeah.
I hear. Well, Sean, since you're talking, what's your pop culture pick for right now?
Oh, since Sean barged in, we may as well let him have the microphone. Is that what that was? Okay. Anyway, so
I didn't say that out loud.
I'm kidding. I'm kidding. I'm kidding. No, I'm actually. Thank you for that. I actually am going to check out the Tick, and I'm glad to kind of know that I need to go in with perhaps some slightly different expectations, because I was going in expecting, I hope not. That's where I keep all my stuff and things like that.
No, it's pretty cool. I mean, there is this ongoing subplot about how there's a vigilante hero who's got a boat called, I want to say, Justice Boat, and that's his fairly useless superhero vehicle, and it's sentient. It develops a crush on Arthur, and it gets really creepy about it. And but they just play it completely straight. But anyway, you're saying.
Does somebody have some air conditioning going or something? Because there's some like really loud woof, woof, woof coming across the microphone somewhere.
I think it's coming out of Ryan. Ryan, can you just hit the mute button real quick? Give it a try. Oh, there it goes. It's
Yeah.
done.
I didn't do anything.
Oh.
Oh.
Not sure what that was in. Anyway, so I just. My problem is I can't keep up with all the pop culture of the like most recent stuff. Like there's people always talking about the stuff that they're watching because they're catching first run or whatever. For me, if it's not on Netflix, it was Netflix and Amazon Prime, but now we just recently got into Hulu. So I'm catching some cool stuff there. But whatever the latest, whatever's on those is what I'm into. So I'm currently going through the most, for me, most recent season of Marvel Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., which is the one where Ada, the AI, is featured pretty heavily along with the Watchdogs and the anti-Inhumans thing and the new director and all that kind of stuff. Just watched the first season of Runaways, which was completely not at all what I was expecting. And I don't know if I like it, but I really want to see the next season. So I suppose that says something. I watched the first season of The Expanse, and oh my God, do I love that.
Really good, huh?
Oh man, I cannot wait to see the next season of that one. The Expanse is just brilliant, brilliant science fiction.
And have you read the books?
I have not, but I want to. They're on my list now.
They're beefy, really beefy.
And I just finished watching the very last episode of Sherlock, the Benedict Cumberbatch and Martin Freeman version.
I thought it was Cumberbun. Is it not Cumberbun?
Bindle Snatch or whatever. So anyway, I see why people had such a problem with the later episodes when they really broke away from, quote, established canon. But never mind the fact that this was set in the modern day and was completely retwist on the whole thing. Anyway, I thought it was brilliant. Loved every bit of it. And you know, definitely I'm sad that that's over, but it was very well done. And and Orville. I watched the first season of The Orville and actually really, really enjoyed that way more than I thought I would.
I'm a big Orville fan myself. I thought it was the best Star Trek since, in decades.
Yeah, right. And I have not seen that even one episode of the new Star Trek because I'm just not going to play along with the whole you must buy this to watch this. So when they get around to making it available, great. Tried to keep up on all the CW Arrowverse stuff. I've been really enjoying all of that a lot. So that's me with that. And I've started collecting comics again. So I started following a lot of the DC line stuff and actually really been enjoying Justice League and Batman, Superman, Wonder Woman, all those. There's really good writing and the art is amazing on those.
If you get a chance, Aquaman has been awfully good lately.
Oh, all up there, all up in the Aquaman. I decided to just go ahead and go for it, and I'm collecting all of the Justice League itself, and then all the characters who are in the Justice League, I'm following their titles.
Yeah, we actually had Dan Abnett, the writer of that, on here last week.
Nice, nice.
Yeah, that's always a good time. Ryan, so what are you into these days?
Well, I'm reading old stuff, and I'm reading second edition Planescape PDFs. I got my ancient Kindle fired back up, and I downloaded them all in there so I can carry it with me. I'm running a fifth edition Dungeons & Dragons game at home, and I wanted to do something different, so I pulled out Planescape. So I have so much Planescape lore to swallow and regurgitate to my players right now. So
is that a pretty easy conversion to fit then?
Well, you know, most of it's just lore. There have been a few products that did some conversion on the Dungeon Masters Guild on available through One Bookshelf. I think it's called the Planar Bestiary, and it's someone went through a lot of the planar creatures and converted them to fifth ed, but quite a few of them are already converted in the Monster Manual. The Modrons are in there, and a few of the other weird species that you encounter. Tieflings are now part of Dungeons & Dragons normally. The only ones missing so far are the people who are the Ram Centaurs. What are the Bariars? They were a player character race in 2nd edition, but they haven't really appeared on 5th edition yet. My hope is for the
Daga.
What?
I was being a jerk. I was like, isn't that Ram race one of the races in the comic book Saga?
But in Planescape, they're like centaurs. They've got a ram's body with a human torso and horns. So, and they're a straightforward race in Planescape. So, and they're all over the place. It's kind of weird. So they just haven't come forward. Maybe they were just deemed too odd But then again, the Modrons are in there, so what do I know? Those are those, you know, cubical things from the plane of lawful neutrality. They all take shapes. It's kind of like Flatland, the universe of Flatland written as a Dungeons & Dragons setting. So,
well, let me ask you something completely seriously. I played D&D back in the old days. I never really got Planescape. Can you just kind of summarize what it is that appeals about that setting to you?
Well, it's crazy. It basically takes the philosophical implications of alignment systems and says, hey, we're just going to make an entire universe out of it. And really, they base it on, I don't know if you remember the diagrams and like even the early books about here's the multiverse and here's the astral plane and here's the ethereal plane and all these planes and the elemental planes.
Yeah.
So what they did with Planescape, the original box set, this is back when, you know, TSR did tons of box sets, had here's the map of the multiverse. You open this box set and there's these gorgeous maps in it. You unfold them and here's the multiverse and here's the parts in between it. So all the alignments have their own realms. And there's in-between realms because they love to do those quasi-planes, you know. So there's the lawful good realm, and then between it and the, you know, then there's the neutral good plane. And there's the lawful good / neutral good plane. So there's all these planes, and there's 15 planes, and then there's the neutral plane right in the middle, which they call the Outlands.
And that's we know where... Ohio.
Oh, ah. Ohio, yeah.
Sorry, so that was really funny in my head. Forgive me.
Okay, I'll forgive you. And in the center of it, there's a city called Sigil, and they pronounce it Sigil, even though it's spelled Sigil. And it's the city of doors, and that's where you can get to any place in the multiverse. And it's designed to make multiverse play something that you can do from first level. Whereas in the original Dungeons & Dragons, before Planescape, it was something, oh, only high-level players do that. Well, in Planescape, anybody can. They didn't really change the universe so much as they just allowed different types of stories to happen in that universe. And if you look at the writers of some of that stuff, Monty Cook was working on Planescape. Wolfgang Bauer was working on Planescape. You know, obviously a lot of the other people that worked in TSR were there too. I mean, they had a huge production schedule, much more so now. It seems like they only put out a few books a year. Back then it was dozens and dozens of books for each line. Planescape had a line, Forgotten Realms had a line. And truthfully, I've been playing like Savage Worlds for like 10 years. I've gotten back into D&D because of 5th edition, and I had this box set of Planescape I got at Gen Con 10 years ago that I've always just kind of like, man, I'd like to use that someday. So I pulled it out and started using it. I don't know. You can always step into the Forgotten Realms if you want to. Hey, we'll have an adventure in the Forgotten Realms this week. But then again, you can also, hey, we're going to go to the Seven Heavens. Or we're going to, you know, go to the abyss, and you can do that. So it's just kind of an interesting setting and not just elves in the woods.
Okay, cool. Yeah, like I said, I just never had a chance to get into it because the guys I was playing with were always just elves in the woods and more 10x10 stone quarters. So it's,
and I love that. I love that too, but, you know, I want to throw some Yugoloths at them every once in a while.
Yeah, I feel you. Well, hey, speaking of throwing Yugoloths at people, this is my awkward segue. Oh, wait a second. Walt, well, what's your thing this week?
Yes, if you need to segue for time, I'm good.
Nah, man, go for it.
All right. As we were saying earlier, Sean has a great Kickstarter running right now, and it's boosted a lot of nostalgia. But about 6 months ago or so, our friend Vince White, who is making an incredible line of indie comics called The Powerverse, came out with a very G.I. Joe looking comic I just had to pick up. It's called Chess, and it just happens to be a real love letter to stuff like G.I. Joe and stuff like that. Chess, of course, stands for Command Headquarters of Espionage and Strategic Strikes, because of course it does.
You got to send me a link for that, dude.
I will. I definitely will. And I'll talk to they've only just released it to Kickstarter backers, so I will I'll talk to Vince and see if I can get you a copy forwarded, because it is a really fun title, and I think it would do very, very well if you wanted to play an issue of this in Freedom Squadron. It would totally mesh over. The art is a lot of fun. You can tell they brought in a pinch hitter artist for about 5 minutes just to just to fill some of the void, but the rest of the book is absolutely gorgeous. It's about a squad that's sent to investigate several weird occurrences. And those weird occurrences have to do with the effect that the original issue of the Powerverse had had. If you're not familiar with Vince White's Powerverse, in the very first issue of Will Power, the entire scope of the universe changes, and because of the event that gives him his powers. And it's not the individual that is necessarily changed, but the whole universe changes. Thus, the one guy in the universe unaffected by this change is now superhuman, based on those iterations. But the comic itself is kind of dealing with some of the repercussions of this, and you have a very G.I. Joe-esque team that has been put together and is. Going out to investigate basically an arms dealer. And you can totally feel in the issue the whole plans and operations manual kind of setup that Sean is going for in part of his game. And it really I thought it was a really good choice for this week. So it should be out. I know they do Comixology and then their own store a little while after the backers get their stuff. But if you get a chance, it's called Chess. It's part of the Powerverse. It's very well done, and I highly recommend it, especially if you like stuff like G.I. Joe.
So are they in comic stores too? Do they actually print through comic stores?
I'm not sure.
I'm looking here, and I can't see where I could actually – I'm looking on the site right now, and I can't see where I could buy it.
Yeah, like I said, they just released it to backers, so I'll make sure I send you a couple links. I'm pretty sure they do physical copies through their own store, but I'll get Vince to shoot you a note. He's a great guy and runs a cool company, much like Nick Garber, who just joined us, who is a great guy and runs a cool company.
Hey, that's Nick Garber. Nick, you are the head godfather dude in charge of Apogee Comics, right?
I am the president of Apogee Comics and one of the artists. I'm also the chief financial officer, which nobody really cares about. But
one day there'll be money. It'll be more important. We'll see next to you in our virtual studio is Ryan Lightbugger, who's one of the head designers at Utility Games. And on the other side of you in the virtual studio is Sean Patrick Fannin, who, well, Sean, you've got so many titles right now. How do you like to be introduced these days?
How's it going? So, president and chief visionary officer for Evil Beagle Games, brand manager for Savage Rifts for Pinnacle Entertainment. Those are the two big things. I'm the lead writer and designer right now on this Freedom Squadron thing we're doing, along with a bunch of other stuff. And 30 years, this year makes 30 years I have been writing and designing role-playing game products. So there you go. That's me.
Awesome.
So yeah, I got to figure out what media I want to read this stuff on, because I think this is one of those universes I'd like to go ahead and just throw myself at completely and read all the stuff.
Well, it's the first issue, so you're getting it on the ground floor. Sorry about the background noise. My German Shepherd is having an argument with my cat.
I think I know who's going to win that argument, but that's cool.
Yep, cat.
Well, hey, Nick, we just finished doing everybody's pop culture pick of the week, and we were going to awkwardly segue over to Kickstarter promotion, but you just jumped in, so what is your pick of the week?
Okay, I got three of them, and I don't know what everybody's discussed, so I'm just going to drop three, and you guys just pick which one you want me to talk about.
All right.
The Outsider on Netflix, Mute on Netflix, and Jessica Jones Season 2 on Netflix. I spent a lot of time on Netflix because I had a very lovely back injury that kind of laid me up. So,
oh, well, I'm actually curious about all three of those. What do you guys think? Ryan, what do you think?
I haven't seen Jessica Jones' second season yet, so I don't want any spoilers, but other than that, I'm not.
I've been hearing not good things about it, actually.
They could have shaved three episodes off and it wouldn't have made a difference.
I think that's true of all those series.
Yeah, it seems, I mean, even with the ones that I love, like Daredevil Season 2, Punisher, Luke Cage, Iron Fist, you could have just scrapped all 13 episodes. But yeah, there's always at least two or three episodes that you could just be like, well, this, it doesn't drive the plot forward. It doesn't add anything to character development. It doesn't answer any subplots or, you know, brings up anything new. It's just, it's a dead episode. So, but I won't talk about that. Mute was really good. If you haven't seen that yet, I highly recommend it. And the premise is an Amish guy in the future that falls in love with a hooker. I mean,
it's true.
Who wouldn't love to see that story play out? And what it's great is there's two stories going on that are parallel. And for most of it, you're just like, man, why do they keep showing this guy? I mean, I thought we were focusing on this guy. And eventually they run into each other and it all makes sense. And you're like, oh, okay. So it's been a while since I've had kind of that surprise from a movie. So I thoroughly enjoyed that. Going on to The Outsider, which was about an American POW in Japan in 1954. Who gets released, but before he does that, he befriends a Yakuza member and gets kind of sucked into that world.
Oh, wait a second. That was Jared Leto, right?
Yeah.
Yes. And it was very good.
It was amazing.
I wanted to watch that, but my wife got so turned off by Jared Leto because of some of the promotional stuff that came out about him during Suicide Squad. She doesn't want to watch anything with Jared Leto anymore. So.
Well, the guy's a whack job, but he's a talented whack job, and I'm pretty sure he's a vampire. The guy don't age.
Fair enough.
Yeah,
Netflix is just killing it on the movies and TV series lately. So
yeah, we watched that at the house, and my wife gets mad at me anytime there's any like foreign language films where I speak the language because I like to put stuff on the bottom of the screen so I don't see the subtitles. She gets mad at me.
She's like, they're speaking Japanese. I don't speak Japanese.
Well, that's, she should have learned.
Oh, another one. I mean, geez, I could talk about Netflix here. They should be paying me right now for as much airtime I'm giving them. But the horror film, Veronica.
You know what? I watched that in your recommendation. That was the Spanish language one where it's basically a Ouija board horror movie.
Right. I know I'd mentioned it last time and. I don't know, I kind of enjoyed it. And it was nice. And just going on to what Walt was saying, it was nice to be able to have a subtitle movie without having the subtitles because you speak the language. I was like, oh, okay, cool. I've waited almost 40 years to be able to do this.
Yeah, I've been watching Babylon Berlin on Netflix right now, which is it's a German miniseries about shit getting crazy in Berlin during Weimar Republic. And yeah, same kind of deal with that. It's all subtitled, but I speak just enough German to catch it when they kind of half-ass the translation.
What was the name of it?
Babylon Berlin.
Berlin.
Yeah, apparently it was the big deal show in Germany last year, and we're just getting it here in America now.
Well, yeah, just like that Natalie Portman movie Annihilation, where it got released in the UK on Netflix, but not here in America. It got released on the big screen, but
how was it?
I'm halfway through. I had to stop because I had to take care of some errands. But it's enjoyable. You know, it's definitely it's got a little bit of everything. A little bit of monster, a little bit of sci-fi, a little bit of, is it an alien invasion? A little bit of mystery. Just it's pretty good. And whoever was doing the tactical training knew what they were doing.
Well, that's pretty rare in a movie.
Yeah, because the way Natalie Portman is the soldier scientist in this movie. And I can't give anything away because I'm only halfway through. But when they go into what they call the Shimmer, which that doesn't really give anything away. But sorry, that's my phone. That sounds like the Predator. But anyway, so they go in there and everyone, they're wearing rucksacks and tactical gear. And the other scientists have their weapons slung over the ruck. Big no-no. You know, any operator, any soldier is going to have his... you know, slinging for his rifle, you know, on him first, and the ruck goes on top of that. So in case he has to ditch his pack, he still has his rifle, or she has a rifle. And that's some of the, like, little tiny things that were, you know, shown in that movie that just kind of really sold. I'm like, okay, I believe that she did some time in the military.
Cool.
But it's got some pretty cool stuff. It's a wild idea, and it deals with time lapses and memory lapses and DNA being spliced and going into other organisms, and just there's a lot of weird shit going on in there.
Yeah, I saw the trailer. I was like, you know, I like this movie when I saw it 20 years ago called Aliens, but from what you're saying, it's got more than that going on.
Yeah, it's got some interesting stuff because on face value, it comes off very Aliens.
Okay,
you know?
Cool.
But once you start getting into it, it's like, okay, they've they've taken a story that we all kind of know and then put their own spin on it and kind of, you know, made it a little bit more fresh.
Okay, I'll try to check that out. Well, hey, now is the part on Sprockets when we awkwardly segue to talking about Kickstarters. And Ryan, would you like to go first?
Certainly, yeah. We just launched our Kickstarter for Dagon's Bones. It's the is my wife and our friend Brian Rowe. It's a Lovecraft-themed dice game. The lore of the game is that this is the game that they play in Innsmouth in the inn, and it's a dice game. We've made custom dice, which you probably can't see on your little camera, but there are three custom dice. They share some symbols, but they all have unique symbols on them as well. And the lore of the game is that the people in Innsmouth play this in their pubs, and you roll the die, you read the face, and you can make a decision based on what the face says. So you can either steal from someone, you can steal from the community pot, which in our case we call Cthulhu's pot. The point of the game is to double your starting money, and if Cthulhu doubles his, he wins. So the game starts, everybody gets 5 coins, including Cthulhu, who sits in the middle. And we're going to have custom coins and the custom dice. Like I said, the dice we already have made. And we launched a Kickstarter to bring this out. Right. Formed a little company called Utility Games. And we are, before this podcast started, we were about 28% funded in 2 days.
Yeah, you're coming up on 25 or over 2,500 out of 9,000. So yeah, you're doing pretty well for 2 days. And
I don't want to play dice with Cthulhu. That terrifies me.
Well, that's the point. But the nice thing is, if you're drunk, you roll this.
I automatically love this guy.
Right? See, there's a little drunk. If you get that, Cthulhu can't get you. Because there's a Cthulhu face on the dice. And, of course, in Innsmouth, they worship Dagon and Cthulhu. They worship Dagon because he brings them things. They worship Cthulhu because they're scared of him. So the point is, you're trying, the best roll you can get is 3 Dagons. And I don't know if you can see, the little Dagon looks like a little fish man. If you get 3 Dagons, you get a coin from everybody at the table and from Cthulhu. So theoretically, you could win in almost one roll. In practice, it rarely happens that way. But it is a beer and pretzels game. It's not a deep game that you would play all night. You play this while you're waiting on everybody to show up for your game night or maybe between games. And it's...
Sorry. I was just going to tell people before we went too far, they really should go to Kickstarter page because the art you've got on here is just great. And you have these illustrations of residents of Innsmouth saying things like, I find Dragon's Bones to be a welcome distraction from the constant mental strain of plotting to overthrow the accursed land dwellers.
Yeah, no, we have an artist, John Wigley did our art for us, and Des Hanley did the logo. Brian Rowe did the design of the dice and the design of the coins. I was instrumental in sort of the rules with me and Brian and Cinda went back and forth on the rules, kind of what each role means and how you move forward, the winning conditions, things like that. We're going to put it out. If you look at our Kickstarter page, there's a mock-up, and it's just a Photoshop mock-up of what the game will look like. It's going to come in a durable cardboard tube, the kind of thing you might find like spices in or powders. I mean, it's a really nice, durable telescoping tube. It'll have a decal around it that has the cover art that you see there, the guy throwing the coins in the air. And we'll have a little blurb on the back, and on the inside it'll have your coins, your dice, and your instructions.
So there's not a haster symbol on any of those dice, is there?
No, no, no.
3 dice, haster, that point we have to never speak to each other again.
There's a key that allows you to steal from the community chest, a hook that allows you to steal from the other players. Theoretically, you're taking their catch, you know, from their fishing boat. There's an anchor that's a wild card. And, of course, there's dead fish, which are nothing. So we do a quick play video at the beginning that kind of shows a couple things. And we'll be adding more lore about the faces of the dice as we move forward. But we've kept it simple. We don't have any stretch goals. We have one backer level. And we're going to keep it simple because this is our first Kickstarter as a company. Brian has had a couple himself, I think 3 or 4 that he's fulfilled. But we want to keep it simple. We don't want to eat up our profits with stretch goals. because we're not Hasbro. We, you know, we're dealing with the economies of we're three people ordering 500 of this and 500 of that. So it's illuminating. I will say that I've backed a lot of things on Kickstarter, but this is the first time I've run one. So
you know my description of what running a Kickstarter is like, right? I've published this a few times. It's the emotional experience of running a Kickstarter is you are attempting to pilot an F5 tornado, and I don't mean an airplane. I mean an actual tornado, F5, across the circumference of a Category 5 hurricane while a talking 500-pound gorilla is on your back, daily screaming at you, "You're not doing enough!"
Yeah. That sounds good. And I have a day job and two kids, too. So
that is a very accurate analogy.
Yeah. There's always the $1 backers who.
Yeah. Oh, and then when they back out of their $1, I feel like Liam Neeson in Taken. I will find you.
I'm not that concerned about it. I mean, you know.
Yeah, but $1. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
Come, you backed out of a $1 pledge.
But
come on.
You know that they put $1 in to watch it, and they want you to convince them. And. You know, that's I guess your job is to try to convince them, but you can, you know, you play towards your strengths and you play towards the majority of the people who are on board and interested.
Well, I mean, if that's what they're expecting on a $1 pledge, I can turn into Martin Blank real quick.
Yeah.
If anybody gets that reference, you know, if I show up at your door, you pledged $1. Chances are you did something to bring me there.
Dang.
No, I'm just kidding. I'm not that bad, but I just, that's like, Kickstarters are a very frustrating thing. You get super excited, you know, when the money starts rolling in and people start backing in, it starts getting that steam, and then someone like pulls out on a $1 pledge or a $3 pledge. You're like, why?
I'm more interested in, I have one person who backed without reward for the same cost as the backer level, and I'm thinking they made a mistake.
Yeah, maybe they hit the wrong button. You get a lot of that too.
Well, there's only two buttons to hit, so.
It was a 50-50 chance. I don't know how to screw that up.
I figured if they haven't corrected the mistake, we'll check in with them.
Well, you know, there's a whole tier of people, the super backers. I mean, there's guys out there who backed, you know, $10,000 of Kickstarters the first year Kickstarter was a thing. Mm-hmm. And some of them, honest to God, are just trust fund dudes who just want to, you know, throw their money around and feel like they're doing a good thing.
Well, it's interesting you say super backer. I'm considered a super backer, and I know I haven't spent that much money.
There's a chance that they did it on their phone. The phone interface for Kickstarter is not particularly friendly.
I will say the dashboard is not that friendly on your phone either. So
yeah, so you might want to, you know, hey, by the way, if you did that, just know, we want to make sure you hit what you wanted.
I figure we'll communicate with them at some point. We've got 27 days, and you know, I'll keep an eye. I know their number. I'll keep an eye on them.
I know what I've done with Kickstarters in the past. Anytime someone backs it, I'll go in there and I'll write a message, like, you know, of course, thanking them for backing the project and helping us further along, the usual shtick. And then, are you happy with the tier selection that you picked? You know, so I can get that kind of confirmation.
Right.
You know,
I like to do that too, and send along some personal pictures just to, you know, try to cement that bond. You know,
I wish I had a Kickstarter going on now. I would show them the bruises that are all over my body because they are gnarly.
Put your social security number in there, that sort of thing.
Exactly. Here's my Amazon wish list. And
right.
Yeah, exactly. Well, hey, speaking of Kickstarters, Sean Patrick Fannin, you are currently running the G.I. Joe-esque Kickstarter Freedom Squadron for Savage Worlds, and it has been a barn burner. You initial goal of 8,000, and you have raised, as of this podcast, almost 2,500.
Almost
23,300 and change.
Yep, it's $23,336 according to the screen I'm looking at. We're still cooking along. For freedom, as they say. The thing is, we say yes, it is a love letter to 80s cartoon action heroes because we are trying really hard for Hasbro to stay, you know, nice to us. Now the thing is, actually, the guys who did the original IP of Venom Assault, which is the board game by Spyglass Games, they actually did consult with Hasbro and say, look, as long as as long as you don't cross any of these particular lines, are we okay? And Hasbro looked at it and said, yeah, sure, you know. So we're just trying to stay on the right side of that. But yes, it is absolutely an homage, a love letter to that kind of thing. And at the same time, the whole point is to kind of look back through the lens of nostalgia, but to at the same time firmly plant the design and the presentation of the IP in slightly more updated modern sensibilities. Right. So a little less pew pew, red laser, blue laser, a little less nobody ever gets hurt, and a little more colorful, over the top action adventure, military style heroes, but maybe closer to that Warren Ellis movie where Snake Eyes was running around dropping Cobra guys everywhere.
I was about to ask you about G.I. Joe Resolute, which was a great animated G.I. Joe movie by Warren Ellis that came out 2009.
Yeah, when I got into this project, I had just watched that. I'm like, yeah, I want to get closer to that kind of framework. And I'm looking at the chest that you were talking about, Walt, and going, that looks like it's probably the same box. So taking that idea of really cool code names, neat uniforms and outfits, high tech, crazy over the top villains, but once again, looking back through the lens of nostalgia, but with the sensibilities kind of in the same spot as say the Marvel Cinematic Universe, right? So you look at, it's a little bit more believable, and that's not to say that it's realistic, but the verisimilitude is there. You can kind of go, yeah, this is how you could actually imagine this going to some degree. So, yeah, we're definitely playing in that field, and it is a Savage World setting. It's definitely playing in the Savage World's landscape, which, as people know, I've got a pretty solid foundation in terms of writing and design there. A lot of the stuff that I did with Savage Rifts informed some of my design decisions for character creation here. The idea of translating the iconic frameworks from Savage Rifts over to vocation frameworks here.
I was going to say that vocations are a whole new thing you've got just for this setting, right?
Right. So the idea being, one of the things I really wanted to go for, and we discovered this as we were playing with the Savage Rift stuff, and I wanted to go further with it here. People like the good parts of class without necessarily wanting the restrictions of having a class. So they like the idea of, if I choose this particular framework, I get these cool additional things that say I'm really good at being this, but they don't want to be hamstrung by that. They don't want to be I'm boxed into this now, so I don't get to also kind of go other directions easily where I want to go, which is what Savage Worlds really lets you do. So I wanted to design something that gave them that sense of the cool part of choosing an archetype or a class or whatever you want to call it. And so I want to be really good at being a pilot. So you start with a package of abilities that says, I'm a pilot. That's what I came here into this organization as. They recruited me as a pilot, or they recruited me as a ninja, or they recruited me as an athlete, or what have you. But I can still take the basics of Savage Worlds character creation and go nuts and still make the character I can make just the same as any core Savage Worlds product. And then there's like people like the idea of random. Hey, what's the cool, exciting, gambler-esque kind of element of, I get to roll a die and see what cool thing I get, as long as there's no suck rolls. So that's where the specialization tables, which again, we had that in Savage Rifts, and I recreated that in Freedom Squadron. And it's actually probably going to be pretty much a solid part of a lot of the things I do going forward, which is, again, you get to choose to roll on a couple of these charts. And it may be reinforcing the choice you made. Okay, I'm going to roll on aviation because I'm a pilot, or I'm a pilot, but I want to roll on the black ops chart because I also want to be a cool black operative who also happens to be a really good pilot. And you could totally do that. And you might roll and get one cool thing on the pilot chart or the aviation chart, and another guy might roll and get something different on the cool aviation chart, or so on and so forth. So those are elements that really enhance the character creation aspects, which, frankly, even if you are not specifically interested in Freedom Squadron as a setting, if you were interested in cool modern day, postmodern, even with lots of gear and cool edges and cool character creation options for your Savage Worlds gaming, Freedom Squadron is going to kind of set you up nicely. And that's before we even start talking about the plans and operations rules, which is probably the biggest game changer of all coming out of this project. I guess you guys have heard me talk about plans and operations, right?
Yeah, we saw the live stream you did on Kickstarter a couple times, and then I went to the Facebook page and checked out some of the plans and operations sessions. So it really interesting the way it brings together the game in before the game. So I thought that was neat.
So cool. You have an S3 run. before you play the game.
Yeah, pretty much. Well, yeah.
it very much is the game. So I don't want, the thing is, it's not meant to be sort of, it's not meant to be, well, this is sort of the pregame. No, it's very much part of the game. It is, you could actually do an entire session of just plans and operations. And I know people who already, that's kind of what is a thing for them. God. My typical session is plans and operations. And then we close out with a cool boss battle. And that formula works beautifully. So, and I've got a guy who's like he's part of Fort Hood's training. He does training regimen stuff for Fort Hood, and is like even talked about trying to get me down there to show them how they could apply that to actual military style training sessions and stuff.
Yeah, they'd run it through MDMP.
Yeah, exactly. So the idea basically is, you have the puzzle and problem solving element of here's a card that says it's a tactical or it's a technical or it's a covert or it's a interaction type challenge, and it sets the challenge up. And that what it does is it says, okay, it's time for our face characters to get a chance to step up and be the lead on this type of challenge, or our technical oriented or knowledge oriented characters step up and they get to be lead on that challenge, and so on and so forth. But everyone's engaged, right? Everyone is participating. If you're not lead, then you're providing support, and you get to, you know, creatively describe how as a sniper you're supporting the interaction challenge by taking out the ninjas while your face character is going in and talking to the contact in underground Taiwan. So that kind of thing is a huge part of it. And that's the other part of it is the narrative elements. As Shane, I said this numerous times, Shane Hensley played, and he said, you got fate all over my Savage Worlds, and it works. I find that really awesome, because there's the mechanical aspects of who's going to take lead and who's going to solve this. And we have to game that out. But the players describe what they want to do. They can take the basic element of the mission plan, whatever it is the GM set up as the premise, and then they get to say, well, we go to this bar and I talk to a contact I have there, or we're going to break into one of the enemy's warehouses where we know they're storing these weapons, and we're going to like raid that place and see what kind of information we can dig out of there. And so they get to throw their own ideas and their own scenes into the mix. And what people have really noted is that, you know, that works great for Freedom Squadron, but it would also work great for if you were going to do Eldritch Horror, right? If you're going to do a Rippers or a Deadlands horror investigation, or if you're going to do epic fantasy, but you're in a city and you had to, like, you know, you want to do a Thieves Guild type thing, and we want to do a raid against the Lord's Manor, you could totally run that off of plans and operations. So it really would work for any Savage Worlds game. And hell, I know five different Shadowrun GMs who are already adapting this to their Shadowrun games. So,
with more dice pools.
Well, yeah. Is this like a framework for setting up missions, or what exactly? I'm not quite getting it. Apologies.
Is it the montage sequence? That's the impression I got. Sort of a montage. So
it is definitely meant to let you do that montage thing that you see in the action adventure movies, or Leverage, or whatever, where they're all together talking about what they're going to do, and then you flash forward to Elliot's right. Walking down the hallway and takes out a couple of guards while Parker is low crawling through the air ducts as she sneaks into the server room, or Hardaway is like hacking into the system. So you could totally do a Leverage game. It's meant Excellent. To be the montage. It's meant to be the planning session that the A team is doing as they're about to go into Kabul, and then they're in Kabul doing the actual operation itself. It can also be the montage sequence where, you know, a couple members of the team are going to Hawaii to investigate weird toxic sludge that's washed up on the beach, while another pair or three characters have gone up into the Andes Mountains and are consulting with Swami about mystical issues or whatever. I mean, it could be all over the map, literally a global all over the map kind of travel montage. It could be any number of those things, or it can be as focused as, you know, we're going to run a caper, right? We want to do con men caper, right? Okay, so we're going to set up a con job, like the Great Train Robbery. We watched that movie the other day. You could totally do the Great Train Robbery as a plans and operations game session, where, you know, each situation is like, I con this person into helping us out, or I talk my way past this, you know, person to get us the information we need, or I sneak in and steal the key, or whatever it is. All of those things are played out through this. The system uses the cooperative rules of Savage Worlds and the dramatic task idea of Savage Worlds. It just expands it out into a more structured, very easy to follow process, because there's these cool cards, you put them on the table, they tell you what kind of challenge you have to face. Like, it could be an interaction challenge at interference, which means all the rolls are at -2, or a tactical challenge at jackpot and everybody gets a +2, or, you know, major issue -. So the conditions as well as the type, and the cards also say what skills have to be used to solve the challenge. So a technical challenge is going to indicate all the technical type skills, like computers, electronics, science, those kinds of things. Whereas a tactical is going to tell you it's athletics, it's going to be shooting and it's running, climbing, running, jumping through trees, as Eddie Izzard used to say. Whereas the interaction is going to be persuasion and streetwise and investigation and those kinds of things. And so whoever's lead on that, they have to use one of those skills to make the final roll. But anybody else could back them up, and they could provide a cooperative role using anything that they can describe a cool story about how they back them up. So there's the structured element of, we have this challenge and we have to figure out how we're going to solve it. But then they get to back up and go, okay, so this is the story. We decided to go to X and I talked to Y while Mr. Martial Arts guy snuck in behind me and took out all the bodyguards while I go in to basically dress down the CEO and make him tell us what we need to know.
Cool. That sounds really interesting. I'm picturing myself running a Rogue One game, just playing a sci-fi spin on it, because that's basically a, you know, commando heist kind of mission.
I was going to do the Dirty Dozen.
Yeah.
Heroes.
So similar genre, yeah.
You could do all of those. And again, what you end up with is at some point you set up the boss battle, which is the final tactical combat, you know, Savage World style. And there's a boss and all that. And depending on how well you do during the plans and operations system, there's mission rewards. So there's a motivation to do well, right? It's not just, well, we're just telling a story. No, you're also get rewards. By doing well, you get bonus bennies going into the boss battle. Maybe you do well enough that everybody gets a bonus action card, which basically means they get an advantage in initiative. Like, they all get basically temporary level headed because they got so much information. They got the jump on the bad guys, so they get a better initiative desire. And there's all kinds of other awards you can get. So there is a mechanical reward system that, you know, plays into the gameplay as well as drawing that story element out that a lot of people like having. Like, they get the player empowered narrative is also part of it.
Okay, let me ask you kind of a inside baseball question. I've been setting up some Savage Worlds products of my own right now, and I'm talking to freelancers. What I'm hearing a lot is, are you sure you want to do this now? Because, you know, Savage Worlds Black is coming out soon, and, you know, that might change stuff. You'll have to convert all your books to still be viable. And did you have that fear at all launching this Kickstarter?
Well, as you say, inside baseball, one of my titles is the Savage Rifts brand manager. So I had a pretty strong sense of where things are going. I mean, there's nothing that is in the Commandos manual that you can't already see in essentially Flash Gordon. So Flash Gordon is the preview. If anybody at this point was going to be developing anything right now, then they're going to want to get a hold of Flash Gordon, because you can really see where Savage Worlds Black is going to go via Flash Gordon. Even having said that, yes, we were well into the system. Had I really, depending on the timing, I might have delayed doing this until I knew for sure when Savage Worlds Black was going to drop. But the fact is, that's not a guarantee of when that's going to happen. And so I would say, if you really want to go forward, you can do what I did, which is just go ahead and adapt to the changes already shown in Flash Gordon, such as climbing, swimming, and throwing are all now absorbed into athletics, you know, that kind of thing. Just go forward from there. Now, I'm already accepting that there may be a point where I have to do a small document that says, okay, now that the new version of Savage Worlds is out, here's what you would need to do to adapt your current product, your current Freedom Squadron stuff, to be fully compatible with the latest iteration of the rules. Already planning on that. It'll be a free PDF, no big deal. And we'll probably go in and actually do an adaptation of the PDF. So those who do the electronic, everybody's going to get the electronic copy of the books anyway, but we will update the PDF so people can download an updated version. If it comes down to that, if there's enough significant changes that I feel is necessary, then that's what I'm going to do. It's a viable concern. It's a really good question, but I feel like I've kind of gotten ahead enough of the curve, both on using what's shown in Flash Gordon and, you know, for example, in Flash Gordon, they sort of diminish the knowledge skills considerably. Like they say, it's kind of almost like you really don't want to take knowledge skill. You just want to have, you know, what's appropriate to the setting. So instead of knowledge science, it's science. Instead of knowledge computers, it's computers. And that kind of stuff. So, you know, I have computers, electronics, and all that. I just got rid of knowledge skills. And instead, if you want a much narrower focus, I actually call them focuses. So I just kind of went my own way, and we'll see how well that plays.
Cool, cool. That's interesting stuff. It would probably be improper for me to ask you if you have any firm sense on when Savage Worlds Black is going to appear.
I can only tell you that I believe it'll drop this year, and that's the best I got for you.
All right, cool, cool. That's good to know. Well, I'm really excited for your Kickstarter. This looks like a lot of fun.
Yeah,
got some amazing art. Okay.
I'm just like, I'm going to be that geek that shows up with my MDMP, like, QuickBook.
Cool.
Play. I'm going to go full-on infantry officer.
Absolutely, like, dude. Absolutely.
Oh,
that's one of the things that Shane loved. Shane actually gave us a great testimonial. One of the things that he wanted Savage Worlds to be was if he wanted to play the planner, the leader, the tactical commander character, and the plans and operations rules support that, and there's leadership abilities and special abilities you can generate that specifically let you be that character. Oh, I'm the tactical commander. I have operational planning. I have tactical communications. I have these other special abilities that allow me in game playable terms, not just I have to be an alpha gamer that tells everybody what to do and they have to believe that I know what I'm talking about. Instead, it abstractly but concretely says, because I'm the tactical commander, I can get rid of this bad card and give us a good card. Or because I'm a tactical communications guy, I can give a battle role as a support to everybody at once because I'm providing excellent leadership ideas across the board. So this system, that's another thing that comes out of this, is you could totally play that tactical officer and get the fun of that. And your teammates are going to be, oh, thank God you're playing this character, as opposed to, oh, for God's sake, somebody wanted to be a leader and now we have to all do what they say. No, they're glad you're there. They're glad you're doing it because you're giving them decided concrete benefits because you chose that character type.
Well, until I'm giving them a freaking op order and then they're like, man, you were taking this way too seriously. This thing's 20 pages, Nick. 20 pages. Yeah, but everything's covered.
Now I'm really tempted to ask you to run a demo session for us sometime, Sean. It sounds like Nick would be into playing it, but I don't want to put you on the spot here while we're on the air. But
I'd be happy to sometime, sure.
Okay.
Because what it sounds like, and I've done a lot of tabletop games with fellow officers because we're all freaking geeks. You know, they would love this. They would love this game because we would get together Friday night, order a pizza and tons of soda, and we would just be playing tactical games like this. You know,
one of my early adopters, friend, a buddy of mine, as I said, he's involved in training and developing training programs and stuff like that at Fort Hood, and he's very, very into this. And he runs, he's actually running a sense of games with his military guys. And as I said, he's already said he'd love to figure out a way to get them to bring me down, and he and I work out a program to say, here's a way to use this to gamify some tactical training stuff so that people can kind of work out. And I'm like, I never even mentioned that would be possible, but it's just, I think, so you're onto something there. I think, cause he,
oh, absolutely.
I got,
you were describing everything that is involved with the game, with the tactician part and, you know, the operational part and all that stuff. And my brain was just going right back into, you know, the hive brain of my army mind.
Right.
And I'm like, dude, this has something other than entertainment value. You could use this for wargaming.
What's really funny is so there's those specialization tables I talked about. There's one of them called logistics. It is the sexiest table in the game. I'm not kidding. People look at Black Ops and special operations. And
I would argue that logistics is probably the most important part of it.
Oh, yeah, exactly. I went out of my way. Because you have to realize I went to West Point. So,
God, a ring knocker. I love you.
No. 2.5 years. I got out 2.5 years in. I got out, but I was there long enough to know, to kind of pick up on that. And logistics, man, it's subtle and it's one of the sexiest tables you can roll on.
Yeah, logistics really drives ops. Stuff. I mean, you hear the supply guys say that, and the infantry guys and the operators are all snicker at them, but that's the truth. If you don't have the proper equipment to do the mission, which comes from supply, that's logistics.
Yep.
You ain't doing shit. You're sitting on the fob waiting for everything to show up.
So there are entries on the chart, for example, which you're going to emergency procurement, which basically is like an Uber scavenger edge, material management, resource networking, operational support. They all sound kind of like, but when you read what they actually do for people, they're like, oh my God, we're so glad he's on the team. Oh my God, he's so awesome. You know, that kind of stuff. So, you know, that's, you know, interpersonal communications, you get to use your charisma bonus on logistics roles to help get shit done. I mean, it's just, yeah, it's a thing. So.
It's awesome.
Hey, I wanted to mention the art I'm seeing on Kickstarter is just amazing. Who's your guy for that?
His name is Phil Cho. He is actually a very highly established Marvel and DC comics artist. He's actually involved in a huge DC project right now. But he loves this stuff, and he's just been a really a cool guy and a buddy for us. And we actually, I'm going to give you guys a little bit of exclusive here. Keep an eye out for an announcement. Whereby we're going to hopefully open things up for people to be able to do a pledge level where they will be getting to get their own Phil Cho piece done as their own character in one of the books.
Oh, nice. That's really awesome. Cool.
There goes my paycheck for the week.
Damn it.
I know, right?
So that's coming up in the next couple of days, so we should definitely mention it in the show notes, sounds like.
Yeah, yeah. We know it's going to be all dependent on us unlocking that Friends Foes manual. So people have got to help us get to that Friends Foes level, which we're going to be doing some. We're going to be doing some adjustments on that. I can't say exactly what that is yet, but we're about to make an announcement on that to try to make at least the digital version of the Friends Foes manual a little bit more able to reach it sooner. And if we reach that, that unlocks that book, and that's where that character thing would go. Your own character in the Friends Foes manual.
And Friends and Foes, that's what's the number on that one?
Well, right now it's 52,000, but as I said, we're looking at and I can't say for sure, but we're looking at doing something with that and seeing if we can't get at least the digital iteration of that down to a lower pledge level or unlock level, I should say.
All right, cool, good to hear. I am enjoying this conversation immensely, but I gotta kind of wrap things up. I have to go pick up the kid from daycare and take him to swim lessons, so
Roger that. Yeah.
Need to wrap things up. Any closing thoughts from anybody?
Everything is awesome.
Yeah, this is cool. And Nick's new code name is Big Boy.
Big Boy.
Hey. I just wanted to thank Sean for making the Burster awesome again, because I've played Savage Rifts as a Burster and loved it. So
you're very welcome. Thank you very much.
I do love the charts in the back. I think you did a very good job of that. So I think that you've reinvigorated that whole setting personally.
I truly appreciate that very, very much. So again, I a lot of the things that informed what we did there, I brought over into the Freedom Squadron. So I'll get a chance to check that out. And do me a favor, Ryan, send me a link, email me a link, and I will be doing another Kickstarter roundup soon. And I'll make sure that your dice game is in that roundup.
Awesome. I'll send you that link.
Appreciate it.
All right. Cool. Sounds good. Nick, Walt, yes. Any closing thoughts?
No. Always a pleasure to be here.
Well, we're always glad to have you. Walt, anything?
For freedom.
For go freedom! Back freedom.
Go back that Kickstarter now.
Praise Dagon.
Go! All
right, guys, I got to go. Thanks for tuning in. Listeners, we'll catch you next time on the Banff Podcast.
Thank you. Peace out.